Before we start today's podcast, I want to encourage you to go to dogbehaviorconference.com and check out this year's Dog Behavior Conference. It's a three-day live online event available to anyone around the world who loves dogs and wants to live their best life together with them. Registration is open now and seats are going fast, so visit dogbehaviorconference.com and reserve your spot today. That's dogbehaviorconference.com. Now, let's get to the podcast. If you don't know the work of the amazing Sarah Fisher, I don't know where you've been. You've definitely been living under a rock. She is back by popular demand, speaking at the Dog Behavior Conference. I think she's spoken at every single one we've had, maybe minus one. And the reason why I keep on asking her back is because every year she astounds all of us. She has made me see dogs in a very different way. She has informed how I work with dogs. She has made me question many of the things that I've been doing in the past. I think as trainers, we all evolve. I think the mark of a good trainer is the fact that you are open to evolving. And why I'm so happy that she's decided to speak at the Dog Behavior Conference again is that she is going to again enlighten us with the incredible work that she is doing with ACE. So welcome, Sarah. I know that we fangirl each other a lot. Mm-hmm. That's why you keep speaking at our conference, because you change. Everybody who listens to you, you just change them in an absolutely profound way. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Vicky. That's, yes, quite an introduction. And thank you for asking me to speak again, because without a shadow of a doubt, Dog Behavior Conference is my highlight. This is the highlight of my working year. I love what you've created, and I am blessed and honored to be a part of it for so many years. So thank you again. I just really enjoy being part of the community you've been able to build. And it's really valuable what you're doing. Thank you.
We love having you. And this year you're going to be speaking. The title is Movement as the Foundation for All Behavior, which just makes me really go, yes, because without movement, both voluntary and involuntary, life doesn't exist. I don't want you to give everything away, but why this?
Oh, how long have we got, Vicky? Well, that's true. You know, movement matters, and everything's a matter of movement. And I've just been blessed to have had the opportunity to watch dogs for, you know, 30 years. And I learn something new every day. And every day, these amazing dogs are adding more to my learning when we connect with them at Tilley Farm, because we teach online, but we also run in-person workshops at the farm that are part of some of the online content. And just watching animals move, when we break everything down and we kind of get rid of a few belief systems out there and we just focus on what we see, we really do start to observe animals through a completely different lens. And there are sort of things that I was taught, or things that I heard, you know, way back when I had Cookie Dough Dynamo, very young 5-month-old dog on foster, who really found the whole world completely overwhelming. And she would find movement difficult and body contact difficult and any noise difficult. And what I did was put a lot of that need to move into movement that I had generated, that I'd created. And it was successful, because she was able to connect with me in a different way than through her teeth, because she just mouthed all the time. But luckily, I kind of realized I'd fallen into a trap. And I talk about her all the time, so apologies if people have heard the story before, but she really was the dog that kind of cemented some of the foundation principles of how I connect with dogs through what we now call ACE Free Work. And I realized actually she was struggling to integrate all that sensory information. And as fast as that sensory information was coming into her, it was generating fast action. So the senses and the sensory system and the motor system are very closely connected. you're getting information in and your body's integrating that information and putting it into action. And I always think of, you know, someone who said to me, sensation is the causation for movement. And I love that saying. I think that's just amazing. So instead of thinking about what might have happened, if we just focus on what we see and how we might be able to support that movement, we start to get very different outcomes. So instead of thinking about how could I generate more movement that could be more beneficial in terms of teaching life skills, I realized actually what I needed to do was to support Cookie to soften that movement and expand the movement through her body internally, so she was able to breathe more deeply and therefore slow down and able to actually pause and process this information instead of just constantly reacting to that information. And the outcomes were amazing. And I'd already started to explore the inclusion of sensory items in my teachings. My original background was working with people. And I came across the work of Jean Ayres, an American psychologist who developed the sensory integration theory. And I started to do more sensory stuff with Cookie, giving her control over movement and contact with different tactile information and different sounds that she could control. She could generate sound through the movement of some of the sensory items I was giving her, or she could move away from it. And I was watching the movement, what increased the movement and what interrupted fluidity and what helped her settle and calm and start to find this lovely rhythm. And yeah, people would say, oh, teach more. And I'd be like, no, we need to do something different. Or they'd say, oh, she puts on the brakes because adolescent dogs get overwhelmed and they just get stuck. Then never pair that with movement because the dog will chain that together and just keep stopping. I'd be like, but hang on, movement is a natural reinforcer. Without movement, life literally can't exist, because we're also talking about movement internally, the beating of the heart and respiration and flow of lymph and all these amazing connections through this connective tissue. And we're also talking about movement to seek, the seeking system, curiosity, accessing really vital things that help you thrive and survive. So if movement isn't rewarding and we need to bring in food to help generate movement, that has to be something of value. Because if movement isn't intrinsically rewarding, we've got to ask the question, why? What is difficult for this amazing being to move? Have we given them too much information? Do they need to stop and process that sensory information in the world? Are they painful internally? Is the act of moving back towards home, or maybe the kennel block in rescue, something that is difficult for that animal because of what may happen in that home or kennel, i.e. isolation, whatever. So I just would kind of rethink a lot of these beliefs that were out there. And I just keep coming back to helping people just watch, observe, get rid of your beliefs, get rid of your prior knowledge. I'm not going to ditch it completely, but just start watching movement and help animals find the flow.
Find the flow. Okay. I have a big question I want to ask you before that, because it's a fabulous introduction. Before we get into the weeds, I've had a lot of people asking me, how did you get started? How did you get into this crazy industry? Yes. How did you, Sarah, get started? Not me. But how did you get started? Because I talk about you a lot, and it's like, and people, you know, students especially that come to VSA, and you've taught a lot of them, students that come to VSA are just like, you know, they're interested in people's journeys. So how did you start in this?
By mistake, kind of. I've always been obsessed by animals, not just an animal lover. I was obsessed by animals from as early as I can remember. And I'm writing a thing at the moment, just for fun, kind of about learning and likening early experiences, or, you know, that when you start to embark on that extraordinary world of discovering all this amazing information about these incredible beings, I kind of think we're looking at kind of puddles of information. And I was a happy puddle paddler as a child. And perhaps my puddles were a bit deeper than some people's because my grandmother had rescue dogs and my sister and I were absolutely not allowed to stare at them or maintain eye contact. And we weren't allowed to try and touch them. And when we gathered in my grandparents' house for tea, the dog would be lying by my grandmother's side, the other side of the room, because the dogs had to have space. And as obsessed by animals as I was, that it was completely normal that these animals would be afforded space and privacy if they needed to be shut away. And they weren't there to add value to our lives. They were all part of this family that were gathering, and their needs were important too. And then my aunt on my mother's side had a lovely Labrador called Kerry, and we were allowed to engage with Kerry, but we weren't allowed to touch him on the left hip because he had arthritis in that left hip. And as a child, I will confess to touching Kerry on the left hip, and he growled at me. And I was the one that got into trouble for disrupting this dog who was sleeping peacefully on his chair. So my puddles were a bit deeper, maybe, than someone whose parents and other family members perhaps hadn't had dogs in their life, because we've had dogs both sides of the family for ages. And then when I was on holiday in Portugal, before it became a tourist destination, my parents would be sunbathing on this amazing beach in this little cove. And there was like kind of one local bar and I think one villa that my parents rented. I don't even know how they found it. And then all these little local shops selling vegetables and stuff, and a whole heap of dogs. And I'd go off exploring with these dogs while my parents were on the beach with my sister. And we'd be exploring rock pools. And I have such amazing memories of just moving and exploring with these dogs. And I didn't have food and we didn't have toys, and reward-based training certainly wasn't even considered then, because I'm quite old. And I just enjoyed that connection and that being with these amazing dogs. So that definitely is part of the foundation of my passion for free work, which we'll come on to a bit later. Anyway, so road since I was four, animal obsessed. But the roots into working with animals weren't really that open. There weren't that many open routes into working with animals. And I didn't want to do physiotherapy because I didn't really want to do the human side, but bizarrely ended up doing human massage, studying anatomy and physiology, because I actually wanted to help a friend whose daughter was diagnosed with a brain tumour when she was really small. And we spent a lot of time in Great Ormond Street Hospital. And then seeing these other parents who are, you know, facing the worst. And what could you do to support people? You can't say anything, but actually you can connect and you can hold and you can make yourself available. And so I started to study human massage just as a way of connecting. And that kind of took me off that path. And I'd always loved biology at school, one of my favourite subjects. And that's where I thought I was heading. And then had horses and one had a back injury. And then I was looking for something where I could help him regain freedom of movement despite the pretty catastrophic injury he'd sustained while living on a friend's farm when he was about two. And that did lead me to looking at the work of Linda Tellington-Jones. And she was seeing animals through a completely different lens. And 40 years ago when, or 50 years, oh, I can't remember when Linda started, certainly many decades ago, it was certainly groundbreaking thinking around looking at horses and later dogs with a very different lens. So I started to learn more about that. And then also because of my human interest was looking at some aspects of Chinese medicine through my lovely acupuncturist, who was incredible, and just started to gather more information from participating in movement workshops with an incredible Chinese doctor called Dr. Chen, who kept coming back to that fluidity and mobility of the spine and how beneficial and, you know, how beneficial free movement is in the human. And was that the same that I considered in animals, because he knew I had horses and was a rider, and absolutely that's what we consider in the horse world. And I started to recognise we didn't really think about this in terms of dogs. And as a child, I had anatomy pictures on my wall of horses, but there wasn't that much available in the dog world. So when we used to host teaching clinics at the farm, I asked my friend, who was then a veterinary physiotherapist or newly qualified veterinary physiotherapist, to come and teach anatomy and physiology. And we've just been adding more and more layers. And I didn't ever really mean to work full time with animals, although that was always a childhood passion. It just kind of grew because I started to see more and more detail in dogs' bodies, coat patterns, looking at quite specific postures that linked with quite specific behaviours. And I was so lucky that I was invited to share that information on different platforms in person. Zoom wasn't a thing back then either. And I got to connect with amazing people who were friends, you know, for many, many decades. And yeah, that's kind of how I fell into it, because it was just sharing information that people could see, but maybe people hadn't really considered before. That's a really long answer, right?
But I love the journey that people take.
Yeah, me too.
Because everybody is different. And yeah. So now I understand now even more about your journey into this whole field, which is, sure, which we could sort of put under the umbrella of dog training, but actually it's so much more than training dogs. And that's something that I do want to discuss with you. How did you go from that to where you are now with Ace Freework? What was that journey like? Because I've known you. I knew you since sort of T-Touch days.
Yes. We've known each other a long time. One of those
long time
connections, yeah, that's still very valuable to me, Vicky.
100%.
So I was sharing all these observations that I was discovering and looking at links with the tail and how that actually could be linked to what might be going on in the rest of the spinal column, and looking at ear position, saying, well, hang on a minute, we've got reduced mobility in the left hind leg, for example, and that left ear is high and rigid, and seeing that pattern in both horses and dogs, and starting to share that when people were inviting me to maybe come and teach some workshops in animal welfare organizations, and me being able to sort of help them with part of their assessment. Me saying, look, it's this dog's really stressed, or we need to do some slow movement with them, and they're worried about hand contact. So from my human knowledge, what can we do to influence that tactile system? Let's get lots of different things from around the kennels that the dog can start touching with their nose or their paws. And the results were phenomenal. So we didn't have snuffle mats either, but giving dogs access to touching, bunched up towels, dog beds, feed bags, the mats from the footwells of cars, you know, anything we could lay our hands on, and letting the dog start to just walk over them and explore them, just help them to start settling, to become curious, because we're tapping into a dog's innate need to move, explore, and be curious. And more people would invite me to share that with their own animal welfare organization, because that's where my heart really lies, in rescue. And that gave me a really good foundation, because we were working within the same environment. So what we were seeing wasn't being influenced by the behavior of lots of different people, if that makes sense. We were seeing all these animals in the same environment, many of whom were struggling with that environment because their world was turned upside down. But I started to see profound changes in the way the dogs then lived within that environment, following the experiences of exploration and quietening. And one of my big passions when I'm teaching in animal welfare is to be mindful of movement. And we need to be mindful of movement all the time, because the nervous system is learning all the time, and the body does remember everything. The nervous system remembers everything, even if we can't actively recall a memory, or we've only got a choppy snapshot of a memory. Our bodies remembered it all. And that was a lesson that I learned in my 20s when I was learning massage. that we were doing something, we're doing this learning exercise or learning experience, and I had to move someone's body. And because of what we were doing, this person couldn't stop me doing it. I wasn't forcing it. It's like, we're doing kinesiology, we're doing muscle testing. And it brought up a horrific memory for her where she had not had control over her body. And that has stuck with me forever. I was in my 20s. Like, we have to be so mindful because we don't know what memory we might connect with when we're teaching an animal. Because I think of education, you know, all round. Are we putting them in an environment that's difficult? Are we making a move that they might associate with something that was traumatic in their past? Is an action that we might perceive to be rewarding actually really aversive for this amazing being because of their past, or maybe just because of a lack of experience? And I kind of question all these phrases, oh, that was a disproportionate response, or, oh, that behavior was out of context. Because actually nothing's ever out of context as far as the nervous system is concerned. So the more we were able to support these animals and change their relationship with themselves, and the more we focused on their internal environment, the less disruptive that external environment was, even though we couldn't change that external environment. And it's just grown and grown and grown and grown. And the dogs in rescue, particularly those at Battersea, are truly my greatest teachers, including some of those who came on foster to Tilly Farm, and particularly Cookie Dough, who I ended up adopting, of course. And she really laid the foundation for the value of thinking in terms of education and not just reward-based training, because I'd fallen into the trap of teaching specific skills with kind of, you know, end goals. So teaching movement, but actually what we've discovered at Tilly Farm is if we allow open-ended movement, either, you know, i.e. no beginning and end to a little sequence, that we accelerate learning, we find out the preference of the dog's learning style, and the dogs are free to opt in and opt out because their nervous system knows exactly what it needs to start finding and then ultimately maintaining balance. So it's been an adventure. It really has. And it's an adventure that just keeps growing because we just see more and more detail that really makes me question more and more and more of those early beliefs that I was listening to probably passing on as well, or definitely passing on. And like you say, we should be evolving all the time. And if we're going to be in a position of teaching, whether that's teaching animals how to navigate the crazy world or teaching students what delightful discoveries we've made, we actually need to be an even better student. That's how I feel. And we certainly should always be a very humble student of the dog.
I love the way you put that. In order to be a teacher, in effect, you're saying you still have to be a really good student.
Yeah,
you have to be open to acquiring knowledge all the time.
Yeah.
I look back at some of my old It's Me or the Dog, and I'd been training for, 8 years at that point, right? And the beginning episodes in the UK, I'm still very proud of what I've achieved, but I do look back at some of that and go, oh my gosh, the belief system was different. The way that I did stuff was different. And even though kind of the bedrock principle of being positive, for want of a better word, was very much ingrained in me right from the start, I think that, you know, I'm very thankful for my journey, and I'm very thankful that I have been open enough to evolve, and I feel good about where I am now. I still feel, you know, you say that dogs are the most important teachers. They are. And I always say this of like, the dogs are just dogs. They are dogs. They've always been dogs. They always will be dogs. But it's humans that are taking a long time in trying to kind of truly understand them and live with them. And give them what they need. And at Positively and at VSA, we evolve all the time, and we are moving towards, as you say, a more kind of an animal-centered approach, right? A care-centered approach. And that's, I think, where we need to be. And so when I look at, with the best intentions, all of the skills that we teach dogs, and especially those skills where, well, we call them skills, we've changed our definition of skills, but when we taught dogs and when we still teach dogs, what shall I say? Behaviors that confine them into a set of artificial poses.
Yeah.
That maybe they don't want to do at that time.
Or maybe they can't.
We're actually. Right. And maybe they can't. We are maybe causing more harm than good. And so that's what I want to explore. We're going to come back after this quick message. It's my favorite weekend of the year. Okay, maybe after Thanksgiving and my daughter's birthday. But it really is something I look forward to all year long, the Dog Behavior Conference. It seems like I say this every year, but it really is true. The 2024 lineup of Dog Behavior Conference speakers has me as fired up as I've ever been for what I truly believe is the most meaningful, enlightening, impactful, and inspirational event available to dog geeks like you and me anywhere in the dog world. With speakers including returning favorites like Sarah Fisher, Mike Shikashio, Arik Bloom, Andrew Hale, and Sarah Heath, to newcomers like Robert Hewings, Marty and Mikhail Becker, Lisa and Brad Wagner, and more. The range of topics covered is custom tailored to serve you no matter where you are on your dog journey. A wide-eyed newbie figuring things out for the first time, or a longtime professional trainer or shelter rescue worker looking to fine-tune your skills and knowledge. It seems like everywhere you turn now since COVID, someone is offering yet another online event, course, or conference, promising the latest and greatest in dog training knowledge. But we've been doing this for over a decade, including in-person dog behavior conferences since 2010, to accompany our longtime Victoria Stillwell Academy and Positively.com courses for guardians and pet pros alike. So go to dogbehaviorconference.com now to check out the DBC and secure your seat today. Registration is open and available to you wherever you are in the world. The live event happens from April the 19th to the 21st, but you'll automatically get access to all of the recordings from the conference for 12 months. So it's okay if you can't join us live for some or all of the weekend. The DBC is special, and I'd hate for you to miss it. So visit dogbehaviorconference.com now to get your ticket. That's dogbehaviorconference.com. And now, back to the podcast. I'm speaking with Sarah Fisher, and now we're going to delve deep. Because I have this problem, Sarah, which I know, which, again, you have influenced me in such a big way, of confining dogs into positions that are good for us because they help us control, but maybe aren't so good for the dog. And I'm not talking about, I don't want to talk about, or I'm not focusing or dissing anybody who does obedience competition or obedience training. I have my own thoughts about that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about every day teaching a dog to sit, stay, lie down, or putting a dog in a crate, or, you know, Can we talk about that a bit? Because I do feel that that's causing more problems.
I have to agree with you, and this is such a great discussion, and that's where Freeworks evolved, because it was about meeting the need for the beings in front of me to move. We move. All through the day, we move before we're born. And that spontaneous movement in the womb, researchers in Japan, I think, have discovered that spontaneous movement in the womb is actually strengthening the sensory motor system, and that those spontaneous movements that we see in the babies, and you see it in puppies too, are also part of a rich development that's going on there right in front of us while that glorious being is snoozing. So reading that research, because I still have an absolute love and fascination for the human body, because actually we're not that dissimilar to these amazing dogs, made me start to rethink again that spontaneous movement in the adolescent dogs. And I call them urges and surges, but people see them as a lack of impulse control. And I'm like, wait a minute. Oh, we have to teach impulse control. What? Why? Yes. Why? What is this movement? What is the purpose of this movement? Movement and behavior all have a function, and movement is the foundation for behavior. Because as I said at the beginning, without movement, there can't be any behavior, because life cannot exist without movement. So are these urges and surges that we see, surely they're part of strengthening this incredible sensory system and this motor system and contingency and planning and improving every aspect of an animal's life that they will depend on to thrive and survive. And that's why there's so much spontaneous movement in young children and, you know, maturing adults too, that need to have this freedom to move is integral to well-being, because it's an integral part of life. And so much of what we're doing is trying to control and contain that movement because we have the belief system that it's beneficial. And there, of course, are benefits to teaching dogs important skills that they would not need if they were left to their own devices, such as not dragging someone attached to a lead across a road. You know, that's obviously going to be of danger to both the animal and the person. But I never fixated on the position a dog was in when they were walking by my side. And I'll be honest, I never understood this fixation with this dog being right by my side at heel. All I wanted was that dog to be moving freely, to allow for that dog to meander, because walking in a straight line is not a normal movement pattern. In walk, most animals meander, and when they're moving from A to B, then they'll go into trot behind, the legs come closer together, and then they're going to trot more in a straight line. But that's not going to be necessarily conducive to being in balance by a person who is being outmoved by their companion. I just wanted my companions to be able to meander and sniff and have this lovely lengthened frame and engage both sides of their body equally, not have that body twisting out of balance because the animal's now looking up at me. I didn't see the benefit of teaching crookedness. I just didn't understand the fixation with that. And then I understand why that's important to help dogs walk in balance, but it didn't sit right with me that actually we were teaching crookedness, or crookedness was certainly being encouraged. And it was just because people hadn't thought about it. They weren't being deliberately mean. And then I was thinking about the illusion that some of these fixed postures create. So what happens when an animal lifts their head is it actually starts to shorten the stride. So I was thinking, well, maybe that's been part of the motivation for teaching an elevated head position, because it's actually shortening the stride, therefore it's slowing the movement. But it's actually creating an illusion of slowness, because the minute the animal then is able to move their head into a more balanced position, they're often tipping out of balance because they were never able to find balance in a slow, meandering, fluid walk where the animal's looking ahead or exploring their environment around them. And there's a saying in the horse world, the front foot will go as far as the nose allows. And that's kind of true for dogs. So the higher the head, or the shorter the neck because of discomfort, the shorter the stride in front. And then I started to think about, you know, this amazing nervous system's learning all the time, and people saying, oh, we have to help that dog unlearn, or as a caregiver, we have to unlearn. And I'm like, but you can't unlearn anything because it's already been banked by your nervous system. The nervous system learns in one experience. What we can do is strengthen that learning and create more efficient habits and not practice habits that we've recognized as now being potentially less efficient, but we can't unlearn anything. So dogs are learning all the time. We are learning all the time. They don't just learn when we decide to teach them a specific skill. So how we need to think more globally around their education and thinking about what we're teaching puppies who are new in our home. When we think, oh, I'm going to go and teach my puppy a skill, ditch that. The puppy's learning around that environment and with you all the time. So if you as an adult or your children who are going to be doing spontaneous movement because they have to, because that's a part of learning, that movement's going to be fast. So if you're moving quickly around your home because you've got a long leg and you're busy, or your kids are whizzing around because they have to engage in fast movement and spontaneous movement, not all the time, but it's a really important part of development. Our youngsters are learning to move quickly in puppyhood. They're learning to keep up with us, to follow us, to be a part of that movement pattern. They're mirroring what we're doing with them and around, we're doing around them and with them. We don't then want that fast movement when the animal's getting older and now can outwalk us. So now we have to start teaching these closing movement patterns. But we've expanded that movement pattern through whizzing or through life because life is chaotic. So I'd be really mindful of slowing down movement, even if I was rushing through the yard or up the drive. If I then went into the house, I'd take a breath and walk in and encourage my family to do the same. Excuse me. So those youngsters then went, whoa, wow. And it's the same with treat placement. I'm really mindful when placing treats because absolutely I use food rewards. And when we're throwing food, what we're doing is speeding up the nervous system again. So the dog's, you know, grabbing the food that we might have scattered quickly. I think about it all and how we fall into traps that we then have to try and help the dog unlearn. Well, they can't unlearn it. So how about we just try and get it as right as possible from the earliest stages of this incredible banking that's going on with this dog's nervous system?
When we put dogs into positions, and I'm not saying you don't teach a dog to sit. I'm not saying that if you're teaching a dog to lie down or do a downstay, that that's wrong. But when we're talking, when we're teaching our dogs to do this, and let's say we want safety, right? We want our dogs to sit before they cross the road. I'm kind of on that. Like I'm absolutely fine. My dog actually just stands. And
how about just a wait?
No, exactly. Yeah. Just a wait. Right. So I'm very much of that. Like I don't want to teach my dog to sit before they cross the road and or sit before they go out of the door. I think wait is very underused, but I think it's an incredibly powerful cue to, I love the fact that it's just a check-in, a little pause. It's like a little connection. Hey, just, okay, now we can go. It's that connection. But people still are fixated on teaching that sit. They're still fixated on teaching a down. Why do you think, well, I think I know the answer to this, but why do you think people want to do that? Why are we so focused on it? Is it bad? And what can we do instead?
I don't think it's bad, but a dressage, amazing dressage, Olympian dressage coach, was teaching a horse clinic, and I was very lucky to sit in on that. And he said, I take what the horse offers and I build from there. And that was I love that. So I applied that principle to educating dogs. And my first principle when meeting a dog for the first time is, what am I going to learn from them? What can I learn from them? What do I need to learn from them? Not, oh, great, what am I going to teach them? So I wait for the dog to offer that sit. I watch the dog starting to soften in the body and start to relax. We create a framework where they absolutely start to offer these behaviors that we can then build on. So Henry, when he was 5 months old and he came to my farm in 2017, I think he was so similar to Cookie Dough. overwhelmed by the world. He had bilateral hip dysplasia, I discovered, issues with his knees. He had vomiting and diarrhea history because he was allergic to chicken and he was being fed chicken because his darling caregivers didn't know what else to do. And people think chicken's really good for vomiting and diarrhea, but actually can be the cause of it. And they didn't know that. How can they know that? So many people don't know that. And he could not sit. He needed to move. And both Cookie Dough and Henry would have been tortured if I'd crate trained them. And I could have shaped that. And I could have contained them, but they needed to move. So a pen or a quiet, safe room, because they absolutely needed rest time as well, because rest is in, as important part of learning as well. But that's movement, but it's just slower. And there's more movement through the rib cage as they're going into deep sleep and lovely little twitches of processing in that REM sleep state. That's still movement. But if I'd contained them in a crate, I would have taken away choice of how they could sleep, where they could sleep, when they could access meaningful items that they might have needed in order to decompress. And I would have safe stuff left out for them, obviously. I would have taken away a choice in terms of their sleeping posture, because potentially, because so many crates are too small, and some dogs like to sleep on their back, others like to lie straight out. I would have taken away choice of what type of substrate they wanted to sleep on and when, because we have one bed in a crate, whereas in the rooms I would have lots of different types of bed and different shapes of bed, and also different water bowls available to them too, because some dogs have a preference for a very specific type of bowl or location of bowl. And also in my experience, dogs tend to drink when they move location. So if we've only got that water in a crate, we're taking away that choice of the dog moving and then drinking. They're contained in a tiny room in that crate with their water. And when Henry was given a chew, what he and Cookie Dough, and she was the same, wants to do was explore this novel item, throw it in the air, bash it with paws, roll on it, put their scent on it, fling it around the room again, lie down, chew it, fling it again, and move as they were chewing. They didn't just lie down and gnaw. So again, all of that choice for those really important decompressors would have been taken away from them if I'd focused on crate training. Crate training has a value, absolutely, in terms of maybe they have to be at the vets, or maybe they need to have movement contained because of surgery at some point in their life. Also for safe car travel. So it is an important part of a dog's education, but it shouldn't be used to contain movement. Because we don't know how to create an environment that allows this young being to move. They can obviously be of value for helping animals be a part of a situation where it might be not appropriate for them to be moving around, provided the dog's really comfortable there. So I'm not anti-crate at all. I'm anti-overuse of crate. And I think it's the same with any fixed positions. And I see lots of dogs will go down on a queue, but then they're waiting. They're not blinking. They're waiting for that release. They're not relaxed. And going down on a cue is not the same as relaxing and being able to lie down and process all that lovely sensory information around you in a calm and peaceful way. So I think we need to really think about, why might we need to teach something? Is it appropriate for us to teach it? And how are we going to integrate this into that animal's learning experience? And my experience is we need to wait for that dog to offer that behavior. So for Henry, sitting meant he couldn't move. Plus, he was painful. And he was a dog that absolutely needed to move, like Cookie Dough, as I said. So what he really enjoyed doing was paws up on something in free work. So I took that, because I didn't want him to not be part of the social scene at the farm when I was feeding horses. But he was too young to sit outside the fencing while I went and fed the horses in the field. So I took his love of paws up. I took what he offered and I built from there. And I flipped over the feed bowls out on the yard and gave him the paws up cue that I'd started to add. Once he offered the behavior, then I added the cue. And he would stand with his paws up while I was washing the feed bowls. And then we practice that in different locations, by the feed room door, by the tap. And then ultimately I took one feed bowl empty out to feed the horses, flipped it over on the grass, gave him his paws up cue, and he could stand and he could watch me go into the field, because all my fields are post and railed pretty well. So dogs can come in and out, but I really don't encourage that at all. So I just do a lot of reinforcement for staying out. They're never punished for going in, obviously. Could feed all the horses. Henry could be part of that social experience and he could stay safe, plus do something, that a movement that was meaningful for him. So find out what is meaningful. And I've shared my life with two Maremmas, and Maremmas kind of aren't really into repetition. So why teach a recall? They'll be like, I've already covered that ground. Why am I coming back across the same piece of ground? And that's where a wait can be really valuable, because if they were getting too far ahead, I could just say wait, and they just wait until I caught up with them and invited them to do a different path, because they're like, done it once, I'm not going to do it again. Right. Yeah. It's not meaningful for them. And that's the other thing in free work, which is basically lots of enrichment items at a height that's accessible for the dog emotionally and physically. We are able to find a dog's individual learning style. What is meaningful? What do they actively choose? But also, what do they actively avoid? And it's a game changer. And being able to sit back and just watch dogs has thrown up even more questions about the length of experiences, the greeting patterns of dogs, what we're teaching dogs to do in terms of go and approach that person, touch their back of the hand and come back. No one dog does this. When they are free to start gathering information and send a little friend request in their own time.
They, once you'd said this to me, I saw dogs doing this all the time, because, you know, the week that we're actually recording this podcast is Dog Bite Prevention Week here in the United States. And a lot of the information that's given out there is, you know, put your hand down, let your dog come sniff your hand. And this year I was like, but wait a second, why do we want the dogs to come and sniff their hands? Because if it's just left to the end of devices, aren't they getting as much information as they want just by sniffing your feet or the lower portion of your body?
They do this unbelievable sequence.
Yeah, carry on, talk about it.
I get so excited and I just love spending time with you. I'm sure I've taught, or I've certainly included someone teaching dogs to go up, sniff someone's hand, turn back and be given a treat by the person who has the leash.
Yes.
I've certainly seen that, certainly been a part of that. And it's kind of never felt right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so in free work, if it's safe to do so, dogs are at liberty. If not, we have them on a line and it's still a meaningful experience for them. And sometimes it's not the dog that needs that safety connection. It's the person, the caregiver, the guardian that needs that connection with their dog, particularly if they've had to micromanage for different reasons. So we always do what is right for that dog and that human partnership. And every single dog, I've watched thousands of dogs over the years. Every single dog, Vicky, regardless of age, regardless of breed type or background, does this amazing sequence. So they come into the free work and they just glance towards two or three of the people watching, and we'll have between 5 and 10. And when I used to teach away, we'd have 25 people watching. They just do this amazing sequence, glance towards 2, 3, 4 people, go and explore free work. Then they start to glance towards those people they've already looked at, and they start air scenting towards them. Then they go back to free work, and then they do this really casual walk by, and that distance will vary depending on the dog's confidence level. And they'll walk by the 2 or 3 people they've air centered towards, and then they might glance at another 1 or 2 people and go back to free work. And then once they've done that walk by, that might be it for that session, or they might come and start scenting the shoe and lower leg of the people that they've done the walk by, and then they walk by some of the other people. And they do this incredible sequence, and it's rarely more than three. It's nearly always one or two people. And it's often at the people at the end of the line. So if you have someone that's slightly worried about dogs, not enough, you know, worry to obviously not be in that situation, because obviously we wouldn't have someone really anxious around dogs in that kind of environment. But if someone's like, oh, I don't really, you know, want a big dog jumping on me, don't put them on the end of the line, because that's where that dog's probably going to go, to the people at the end of the line, because it's easy access. They've got their exit route. And I always want that for a dog. It's what I call, oh my God, what do I call it? I can't remember. The get out clause. That's it. I was thinking contract, mm-hmm. but it's a get out clause, because it's really important that whatever we do with dogs, they've got this get out clause. And then they, once they've done the sort of lower leg, they start ascending from the hip up. So they start to scent the trunk, and then they finally, and this could be 2 days later, come around and they air scent in the direction of our breath, because our breath has this unique signature like our fingerprint. If a dog's physically uncomfortable or emotionally uncomfortable, or physically unable to put their head down, so they've got super long legs and they don't feel very flexible in the body for whatever reason, they might actually start that scenting from the hip up. But they all have done this glance towards, air scent towards, walk by, then this amazing scenting pattern. Puppies all the way up to senior dogs. I say all, but three dogs haven't. Three in the thousands I've watched. And they were dogs that humped. They rushed in and humped. And that's arousal and conflict and social pressure. But once we were able to guide them back to free work, because their caregiver had already learned some skills to support that dog, once that arousal was reduced, they started this sequence. And I'm sure it's because it was interrupted when they were young. They were overwhelmed. And most enthusiastic greeters, in my experience, have got body tension and more often than not chronic pain. So teaching proximity is overwhelming. And also, at what age are we teaching this? Because dogs naturally become more body defensive as they enter adolescence, and body contact naturally becomes aversive. So the sensation of movement of the skin, because I think of the skin as part of that movement pattern too. What's the mobility like under my hands, or what's the mobility like when I'm watching a dog? When I see that skin twitch, or the muscles underneath that makes the skin twitch, that tells me a structure is trying to lengthen that hasn't been lengthened for a while. So I'm looking at movement all the time, including movement in terms of the direction of the coat. Where's that hair growing? Why is that hair rougher, coarser, curlier in that area? All of that's giving me feedback about what's going on beneath this incredible, glorious coat. And yeah, why are we so unaware of these beautiful movement patterns, this beautiful gathering of information? Where did we become so focused on us needing to teach the dog everything about their life? They're already equipped to process and navigate their way through the world. We interrupt them, we disrupt them. And it's time to kind of unpeel some of those layers and rethink the way we educate our amazing canine friends.
Yeah, we're so focused on containing them, controlling them. Yeah. We talk about impulse control. You know, self-control is important. Self-control, control. Self-control is different, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, but when you meet a dog's needs, guess what? They can suddenly self-regulate. Isn't that a thing?
Exactly. Yeah, isn't that amazing? Right. I know. Yeah. It is. It is an amazing thing. So we're so focused on that. Now people listening are going, oh my God. Oh my God. So if you want to learn more about this, and I'm telling you, I told you, it blows your mind. It, when you either, you know, you listen to Sarah speak or you do her courses, it just changes the way you look at dogs. So if you want to hear more, and if you want to hear Sarah's presentation, then do register for the Dog Behavior Conference, dogbehaviorconference.com. Wow. You're opening the conference, Sarah. You know that. You're speaking. You're the first speaker in the morning. Yes, you are on Friday morning. And I'm very excited for that. I really am. And thank you so much for coming on to do this podcast.
Thank you, Vicky, always.
You're a champion and a game changer.
Well, thank you. You're bringing so many amazing people together. And it's a joy. And I'm honored to be a part of it again. Thank you.
Well, we are honored that you're speaking again. And thank you for advocating for our dogs and for helping to change the way that we look at them and the way that we interact. And again, I learn so much from every single presentation you do. If people want to learn more about ACE, where would they go?
We have a really lovely Facebook group called ACE Connections, and people can put up videos, and they do saying, can you look at this dog's movement for me? I'm suspicious of something going on for my dog, or here's my first attempt at free work. And we always give feedback, amazing supportive community. But if you wanted to do some online learning, we have online courses that you can enroll in through www.animalcenterededucation.com. Or you can email the Tilly Farm office for more information on some of the longer modules to become an ACE trainer.
And you really are kind of, you spread across the globe. And I do remember when I was working with police dogs here in Georgia, that we had a police dog with one of the departments, a fully functional police dog, that was starting to growl when people touched him, especially his family. And this was very odd. This was out of the ordinary, and they were very worried. And I was like, "Yeah, I want you to take a video. First of all, I want you to take a video. The dog walking to you and walking away, because I had contacted you, because I want to show my friend Sarah Fisher about this." And you indeed said, "Look, there's something going on." When she saw the video, there's something going on. The dog had X-rays, and there was some hip dysplasia there. And if it hadn't been, you know, for a fabulous handler who was like, I'm suspicious, something else is going on. If it hadn't been for a fabulous handler who, if he hadn't been so good, he would have probably just disciplined his dog. But he knew something was off. And for you, this dog wouldn't have continued in, it was put on pain meds, and then there was a lot of physio done. But recognizing what this dog was trying to say, you know, that so it doesn't matter that this isn't just like a little soft snowflakey thing for, you know, your little Shih Tzu at home and your companion. I mean, we're talking dogs of all kinds. I mean, we know Cookie Dough, we know Henry. I mean, we're talking about fast dogs. We're talking about all kinds of dogs, including working dogs, where I think working dogs need it just as much. So, I thank you for that. The police department, thank you for that. That dog went on to have an amazing career. Thank you. So, do come and listen to Sarah speak, dogbehaviorconference.com. You've got a week left. And thank you so much for speaking, Sarah, and I can't wait to see you.
Joy, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I told you she's amazing, isn't she? And you want to learn more? Then come register with us. All right, take care, and I will see you on the next podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to Victoria Stilwell's Positively Podcast. For Victoria's online dog training courses, more information, and helpful dog training tips, visit Victoria's official website at positively.com. Get connected on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media as Victoria Stilwell, and follow her on Twitter at Victoria S. Learn to become a professional dog trainer with the Victoria Stilwell Academy at vsdogtrainingacademy.com. And be sure to tune in next time as Victoria helps you and your dog live your best life together. Positively.